Hey guys, it's your host Julian. This week I'm sitting down with Looney Tunes cartoon supervisor and producer Alex Kerwin to talk all things Looney Tunes, both new and old. I want to give a special shout out to a couple of our patrons that help make this podcast possible. Bill, Brent, Brittany, Call Me Spikey, Eight-Legged Bird, Jacob, and Nick. Thank you all so much for your support. It truly means a lot. If you want to become a patron and help support this show, check the show notes below and sign up today. Now, let's get to that chat with Alex. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to What's My Head Podcast. I'm Julian. Today I'm joined by Alex. Alex, welcome to the show, man. How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Oh, man. Thanks for agreeing to come on the show. So I figured since this show is typically done with the nostalgic purposes of looking back at our youth and the cartoons we grew up on, ladies, we're going to take a departure from that for just a little while. We might talk some old cartoons, but we're going to talk some newer cartoons with some older characters, man. And that was the Looney Tunes that you got to work on not too long ago. Cut straight to the point, man. How do you go from doing some really, really cool stuff at all of these major networks to getting to produce, be executive producer for, you know, the Looney Tunes?
Well, that was a big surprise to me. Supervising producer, I should say. It was Pete Browngard was the EP, but I was working at Disney maybe close to 10 years ago. I had been art directing Craig McCracken's show Wander Over Yonder. And when that wrapped, they put me in an overall deal. I was just sort of doing visual development on a lot of assorted strange things that they had sort of bouncing around in the development department at that period of time. And that was sort of interesting because these interesting people would kind of move through the studio who would be brought in to kind of work on various things. There were a lot of sort of classic Disney properties that we're thinking about reviving or whatever. But one of the people who came in and was working on one of the projects was Pete Browngard, who I knew by reputation. He had done Uncle Grandpa, which was, I remember when he did the pilot. It was like one of the funniest pilots they had done in that batch. And I knew he was like this very funny out of the box thinker. But we didn't really know each other, and he had a cubicle right outside of where I was sitting. And I remember the first real interaction we had. These are cartoon studio drug deals, folks, where someone will say, "Hey man, I hear you've got a hard drive with like 300 classic cartoons on it. I hear you've got all the Tex Avery's and, you know, all the Warner Brothers shorts and all the, you know, classic Disney shorts." I'm like, "Oh yeah, man, I've got all the black and white Mickeys and all that." And he was just like, "Hey, I'm going to bring in a hard drive. Do you think you could give me, all your QuickTime files for these cartoons?" I was like, yeah. And that was like our first interaction. I didn't think anything of it because I'm happy to share. These are the things I love. Old cartoons. I love new cartoons. I love old cartoons, the whole deal. And and then I remember us, you know, chatting about comics and a couple other things, but he wasn't there for a real long time. And then he left, and then I get a phone call. He wanted to meet me for lunch to talk about a project. And I went, and he said, "All right, so I'm doing Looney Tunes. They've asked me to do new Looney Tunes shorts for Warner Brothers. And I know that you're a really big fan of vintage cartoons, and I want you to come and be a part of it." And I was totally terrified. I thought this was a thing, because I hold Looney Tunes in such high reverence. They're kind of, I think they're the greatest thing in the world, and I did not want to be the guy to mess them up. And so my attitude through the whole lunch was like, "Oh, Pete seems so sweet and this is so great, but I don't think I can be a part of this because I don't know what this project is going to be." But at the very end of the lunch, he started bringing up some pieces of artwork that he had commissioned as visual development. And there was some amazing stuff, including all the stuff that Jim Soper, I don't know if that's an artist, you know, this incredible designer out of Boston. He draws in a very authentic, like 1940s drawing style. Not an interpretation. It feels like he's someone who was plucked out of the 1930s or 1940s and was put right in modern day. And seeing this artwork that he was doing, I realized what Pete was envisioning in his mind, that not only was he going to do new Looney Tunes, but he was going to take it back to the spirit of the sort of wartime shorts, which in my mind, I love all the Looney Tunes, but the like the most delicious, the most, you know, the most flavorful, succulent Looney Tunes are the sort of the ones from the like early to mid 1940s. And because they have this sort of the craziest energy, and they're the most sort of like unpredictably the wildest, you know, of all the cartoons. I love the way those cartoons are drawn. And seeing that he wanted to bring it back to that and sort of capture that, not only was he not thinking of reinventing them, but he wanted to really hone in on the spirit of this very specific era. Then suddenly I was like, oh, I'm on board. Like, this is something I want this to happen so, so bad. And then it happened, and it was pretty amazing. one of the absolute career highlights of my life, that I got to be a part of that.
Now with the Looney Tunes, obviously you said these were so important to you. These were the piece de resistance, if you will, right? They were the chef's kiss of cartoons for you. What made these so endearing for you?
I mean, the short answer is, maybe it's not a short answer. Looney Tunes and classic cartoons in general were sort of, most people say, oh, I grew up with cartoons and they're the nostalgia. I grew up watching these things. In my household, classic cartoons are kind of the religion. Like, my parents are really big animation nerds. My father especially, he's a film collector, and so not only did we enjoy watching these things on TV, but I literally had classic cartoons projected over my crib when I was
cool.
And he was extremely knowledgeable, you know, in a pre-internet era, you know, when all the information about how these things were made, you'd have to get it out of little fanzines and things that were published and mailed to you in the mail. And there was, you know, there was a short list of books, you know, that, you know, the Leonard Maltin of Mice and Magic, and, you know, Joe Adamson's Tex Avery, you know, there's all, you know, we had all those books on our shelf. And, you know, my dad had read so much about all these cartoons. He had tried to see as many of them as he could in his lifetime. And so he's very, very knowledgeable about them. And I grew up knowing, not just loving them, but knowing that they were made by people, and being able to sort of spot the difference. Like, I know the difference between a Clampett and a Chuck Jones, you know, cartoon, you know, by the time I'm in sixth grade, I can kind of like, you know, I can tell you what, you know, what's the difference between Tex Avery and, you know, Fritz Frayling or any of these things. And so the culture of my household was sort of being brought up to sort of study these things as pieces of art and enjoy them because they're funny, but then to really think about why they're funny. You know, it's not just funny because the dynamite blew up in his face, but it's funny because of the drawing of what the coyote looks like after the dynamite goes off. It's funny because of the way that joke was timed. You know, there's so much that goes into that stuff. And I always thought it was interesting where, you know, other friends, you know, people I went to school with, or even teachers, where when they would bring up these cartoons, they would sort of bring them up dismissively, you know, as though like, well, you know, that's that kid stuff that we used to watch. And I was just like, no, this is fine art to be reviewed. And I just remember just trying to watch as much of that stuff as I could. By the time I was a teen, one of the Turner channels, I think maybe TNT, ran like a solid block. I feel like maybe 2 or 3 hours of Looney Tunes every weeknight. You know, maybe like, you know, 4 to 7 o'clock. And I just considered it my mission to watch every night and watch. And it didn't matter how many times I had seen a cartoon. I wanted to watch it again because I felt like there was more to get out of it. And I still feel that way. You know, MeTV shows cartoons on weekends. I think on weekdays too, but I put on Looney Tunes. You know, I'm not even working on the show anymore. And I still put on Looney Tunes every weekend, even though I've seen all of them, because there's, you know, I still get something out of watching them, you know, or watching my kids watch it. You know, my 12-year-old son loves watching them too. And I love watching his reaction to them, you know, from what he hasn't seen before.
It's really cool, especially when you have kids and you watch stuff that you grew up with. And then you get to, I've made this analogy before, but, you know, watching cartoons that I watch with my youngest specifically, I get to see what my mom kind of saw when I would watch Ninja Turtles or I would watch Hey Arnold or I would watch anything from the What a Cartoon era, or even that checkerboard era. So she got to see this kid just like not blinking, probably drooling, staring, you know, just mesmerized. And then I get to see that too. And then I get to see his interaction. And I always wonder, I was like, did I laugh at that? Was that something that I found funny too? You know, do we have similar sensibilities and humor? So I really love, like, I don't even have to watch what he's watching. I just get to sit there and watch what he's, I just watch him. You know what I mean? As weird as that sounds. And it's fun.
It's really fun. You know, my kids, you know, my son especially, he really loves the classic Looney Tunes. He really, really seems to love the Looney Tunes we worked on. And so that feeling is sort of amplified when you make something and you put it on and you see your kids laugh at something. Like, you know, when you've worked on a joke and you've tried to get it just right and you put it on and, you know, you see your kid give an audible laugh, then you're like, nailed it. You know? And it doesn't happen all the time, but you know, when it does, you're just like, I thought that was funny. I thought that would work. And it did, you know? So it's very, very satisfying.
No, I have to imagine that's really cool, man. Now with you guys doing the, obviously you said you've seen damn near every Looney Tune there is.
Yeah, I say I've seen all of them. I do get surprised every now and then. There are literally 1,000 of them, you know, give or take. But anyway, continue.
Yeah, you guys were making animation drug deals, as you said. It's funny because as soon as you started going down that rabbit hole when I was in the military, that's what we would do too. We would trade hard drives. I'm like, oh shit, you got that movie? Let me get that one. Or you got that TV show? Let me get that one. You know, so it's wild how unlike, but how alike, you know, both of those situations were. So
it's you know, you find your community wherever you are. You find the people who are like you and you help each other out. There's the things that you love, you know. Now it's very, I mean, it feels like it's pretty easy to find almost anything now, but there've been so many periods that I've been through and probably you have been too, especially being in the military where, you know, resources are limited or whatever, you know, where, you know, it's not easy to find all these things you love. And so you have to find that community where you can hook each other up, you know. It's, you know, I've got a stack of photocopied model sheets from, you know, Iron Giant. Oh man, I'll trade you those for, you know, I've got the Ren and Stimpy model pack or, you know, whatever it is. Or, you know, again, before YouTube, you know, bootleg DVDs or, you know, whatever it was, you know, because you wanted to make sure you had seen everything, you know.
Oh, absolutely, man. There's something about that, you know, with comic books in particular. I still go every Wednesday and get my comic books, you know, so it's something about the thrill of that chase or the thrill of that hunt. You know, it's easy to get on eBay. It's easy to get on Amazon these days. You can just buy damn near anything. But there is something that I really miss about going in and finding something new, whether book, movie, TV show, doesn't matter, music. You know, there's something still fun about that thrill of the hunt. Now, with you just having this vast knowledge of all of the Looney Tunes, and then, like you said, this being your lifeblood, you wanted to work on this once you saw what he was doing going back to that era. Who were some of the directors? Well, first off, who was your favorite out of the Warner Brothers directors? Do you have one or two? And you don't have to have favorites, but I'm pretty sure you go through eras, you know? But who are some of your fondest to look back on?
Yeah. Probably Clampett. I think there's good something choice. So pushed about Clampett. Tex Avery as well. Although Tex Avery, there's sort of an asterisk next to Tex Avery. Tex Avery did, I'm going to say, the cartooniest cartoons ever made in the history of cartoons. But those were primarily done at MGM. He started at Warner's. And that's when he started to kind of get his mojo going. And then it was right when he was like really catching on fire that MGM scooped him up. And, you know, that's where he did his best work, the Droopy cartoons and Red Hot Riding Hood and all of that stuff. So he might be, he's quite possibly my favorite cartoon director. But I wouldn't say he's my favorite Warner's director because I, you know, my favorite work of his was done at other studios. But man, Clampett, there's something so extreme about what he did and unhinged. And you just feel like he's every cartoon he does, he's pumping every possible part of himself into it, that there's like he's jam packing the cartoon to the point where it's going to explode. And it's not, you don't see him viewing these things as products coming off of an assembly line. Not that the other directors did exactly, but, you know, I think they sort of pace themselves and kind of, you know, but almost every cartoon Clampett did feels like it was the last cartoon he was ever going to make before he died, because there is so much energy and so much crazy drawings, and the plot zigzags from here to here to here, and every joke is taken, you know, as far as he can take it, and there's so many ideas packed into every cartoon, so many different types of jokes. And the pacing is always just like rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat, rat-a-tat. There's just so much cartoon in each cartoon that he's pretty hard to beat, you know. And he also, he retires from Warner Brothers at the absolute top, the
peak of his career.
The peak of his career, the year he retires, 1946. If you guys have access, I'm talking to everybody who's watching or listening to this, to go and watch every cartoon that Bob Clampett directed his final year at the studio. They are all bangers. There's maybe one, McCall to Arms is maybe the only exception, but everything else that year, I think, is like Piggy Bank Robbery and Big Snooze and maybe Kitty Cornered is that year too. Just all, you know, cartoons that I would definitely put in my top 50, if not top 20. And so you don't see that period. I mean, who's to say, but you don't see that period of him sort of getting more tired and lazier or kind of falling into formula, or, you know, maybe happened to a couple of the other directors, not all of them, but, you know, they're, the cartoons maybe became a little more subdued in the last decade. He just retires at the absolute top. And then he does interesting things in TV and stuff too. But as far as like his Looney Tunes oeuvre, that's a great year.
Oh, it really was. And he's by far my favorite of all of them. And I had the great honor of talking to his daughter Ruth
Oh,
last
yeah.
year, year before last. And that is my earliest memory of like when you if you watch that episode, she's got a cell of the Great Piggy Bank Robbery right
Yeah.
behind her. And I was like, I've dreamt about that for the last couple
Yeah.
nights. Just these neon, like the reason I like lights like this and neon lights is because of that cartoon, that him walking through, looking down, looking through his magnifying glass, and all of these villains pop up. It's just nothing but visualization. You could pause or you could mute all of it and you know
Yeah.
everything that's going on. That's the beauty of the Looney Tunes. You don't have to listen to any of it. It's great when you listen to it because the music, the character voicing, just everything just pulls. One ups the other. The art ups
Yeah.
the voice ups the music ups it's just phenomenal from start to finish. But
His stuff is just so visually interesting. He let all his animators kind of work in their own style, which is kind of breaking a classic rule. A cartoon is supposed to feel like it came from one hand. The audience is supposed to kind of imagine that one person made the whole cartoon. His cartoons aren't like that. Every scene feels a little different and feels a little, and it doesn't feel like a mistake. It feels like
Very deliberate.
very deliberate. He's getting the best out of every artist. He's getting them to do what they do best. But yeah, I love that episode you did with Ruth. Pete and I met with Ruth as well when we were working on this Porky Daffy movie that we worked on. Yeah, we really wanted to pick her brain a little bit, and she was fantastic to talk to. She's so great.
What was the coolest thing she might have showed you? Whether it was a piece of art, a photograph. It doesn't have to be Looney Tunes, but is there anything you're like, oh my God, I can't believe I get to touch Bob's pen or Bob's pencil or something along those lines?
Well, it's not like we went to her place. She gave us some cool stuff. She gave us these Porky and Wacky Land commemorative memorabilia that I think was done around the time. She had some commemorative cells made. And that stuff is really cool. I'm trying to think of I know that the tidbit. And again, we're such nerds, just every little piece of information is sort of fascinating to us. The tidbit she gave us that we were both really fascinated by and told the most people about, she was like, and he didn't wear a wig. We always assumed Bob Clampett w wore a wig in his later years. Pete even went as Bob Clampett for Halloween a few years ago, and he had sort of a memorable, shall we say, kind of bowl cut, in his in the 70s. She says, "No, I'm here to tell you that was his actual hair. Yes, he dyed it, but he did not wear a toupee." But I don't know if that's what you're looking for, but I feel that's how we
Oh,
talk to a
no,
lot of
that
people afterwards.
no, that's cool, man. I get to do this show because I love having you guys on because you guys gave me something very special. You guys gave me, whether it was in my younger years, a childhood worth having, or it was in my later years now where I've gotten to watch my kids watch the same things I got. So I feel like I get to win twice, well, three times because you
Yeah.
guys come on my show. I got to watch that as a kid, watch it now with my kids, and I get to talk to the people that helped create
Well,
and
then
foster
it's
this.
when you come to it as a fan, it's the minutiae that you're kind of interested in, right? It's just like, okay, well, I've seen the films and I kind of know the deal and I've read a lot about it. But yeah, give me the weird obscure fun facts that only a fan would, want to know.
absolutely.
That's the questions you end up asking, I think, when you're in that situation, at least it is
Oh,
for me.
absolutely. 100%, man, because that's what you want to know. Because you could go and read anything about the production, about the characters, about this and the that's, but it's just the what makes all of that human. That's what people, I think, want to click onto.
Because you kind of come at it as, you know, this godlike idol, and then you realize, oh no, it was just a person, you know, this guy was a dad, and you know. Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Absolutely is. So with that being said, Bob Clampett being such a huge inspiration for you and somebody you probably pulled a lot of inspiration from and influence from into the cartoons you guys were doing, who's some of those characters that you knew, I got to work on these ones because I don't know if I'll ever get this chance again. Was there one or two or three that you had to work on?
Yeah, I think we wanted to. Well, yeah, I mean, I do remember using that term. I wasn't the only one talking about it, but like wanting characters from kind of the Clampett verse to be. We talked about like Beaky Buzzard very early on. That's a character that I think each of the directors did do one cartoon with, but you know, the really great ones were Bob Clampett cartoons. He created the character. I think the dog from Hair Ribbon. There's a few other. We boarded a cartoon with the flea from Itchin' in Time. We weren't able to make that one. But those are sort of like, oh, the cats from, there's a Porky Pig cartoon called Kitty Cornered. That's actually the first Sylvester cartoon, but there's a group of cats in that cartoon, and I was very keen on us doing a cartoon with those cats in it, which we did. There were other Clampett characters that we couldn't clear that we weren't able to use, whether it was because they were parodies of live action comedians who were popular at the time, and they were nervous about, like there's a Abbott and Babbitt and Catstello and things like that. The Gruesome Twosome, some of those characters we weren't allowed to touch, but those were we were very excited to do. Some of these obscure characters, I mean obscure, you know, lesser known characters, I think part of our philosophy, part of why we were so excited to do this, it wasn't just that they hadn't been touched in a long time. I think there are cameos of a lot of these characters in other Looney Tunes things, Space Jam or, you know, other Looney Tunes series. But it was very important to me that these characters not be used for cameos. I was like, if this is a character that we love, we should write a cartoon around this character. So I know some of the characters that I pushed for, Charlie Dog, which is a Jones, Chuck Jones character, the Three Bears. We made two cartoons with the Three Bears. Again, those are Jones characters that he used in a number of cartoons. Very funny, very violent cartoons. Some of the Well, I don't know if Warner's was super thrilled we were bringing those characters back, but they let us do it. Who were some of the other ones? Gosh, there's a couple more that were. Mark Anthony and Pussyfoot are sweetest and the gentlest. That's as sort of cuddly as Looney Tunes characters get from the Chuck Jones cartoon Feed the Kitty. The big it's a big bulldog with a little kitten that rides around on his back, and that Feed the Kitty cartoon is one of my absolute favorite Looney Tunes ever. I've watched it dozens and dozens of times. Again, it's another one I feel like I get something new from it every time I watch it. But those were characters that I was very excited to get to use, and I kept saying, like, because the goal of the project, the stated mission at the beginning was to create 1,000 minutes of new Looney Tunes. And they weren't even super particular about how it was going to be broken down. They were just like, this is Sam Register at Warner Brothers Animation. he just said, you know, the whole project was we just want to more Looney Tunes out in the world. So let's just make 1,000 minutes of it. And that ended up translating to a little over 200 new shorts of sort of varying length. But I just kind of kept talking about, like, I wanted to play with all the toys in the toy box before it got slammed shut. And we didn't. there is still a long list of characters and genres and things that we didn't get to before the clock ran out. But I feel like we got to a lot of it.
Is there one or two that you really wanted to that you didn't get to?
Yeah. There's a few. I mentioned that Flea character. We had a funny cartoon with that, but we had boarded too many cartoons, and we had to cut a few. There were some stranger, obscure things that I wanted to get to. There's a Chuck Jones cartoon called Rocket by Baby, about a little Martian baby who looks a lot like, he's kind of Baby Yoda, you know, decades before Baby Yoda. But I wanted to do something with that character. We didn't do anything with the Chuck Jones character Sniffles, who's kind of a maligned, he was a very early character, again, from when Chuck Jones was in his very Disney period and was doing these sort of cute, cuddly characters. But I wanted to do something with that character. I wanted to do something that was inspired by the comics that they had done with that character in the 50s that were very sort of imaginative and beautifully drawn. Sniffles would go on these little adventures with a girl named Mary Jane, who could shrink down to his size, and they would like jump into a book or things like that. And I thought there was something very cool we could do with that, but we couldn't line up the rights. I think a comic company owned some of the rights to Mary Jane. You know, there are odds and ends. I mean, there's things because we focus so much on the 40s era, there's a lot of kind of iconic 50s Looney Tunes things that we didn't get to play with. For instance, out of those 200 cartoons, we didn't make a single cartoon that had Bugs and Daffy in the same cartoon, because we really wanted to focus on the 1940s version of Daffy, who was the screwball, loony, insane character, not the sort of despicable, antagonistic, grouchy, greedy character that he became when he was paired with Bugs. Because we felt like there had been a lot of stuff done with that sort of version of him and that pairing. But, you know, we did a lot with the loony Daffy. And so we were talking about, well, maybe we should, you know, that's one of the toys in the toy box we haven't gotten to yet. Maybe that would be fun to do something, you know, with that, or like a, you know, kind of a Duck Dodgers, you know, version of Daffy or something like that. But
I love that era of Daffy. Duck Dodgers. Yeah. It's so fun.
Yeah. Those are beautiful cartoons. And those are, I mean, we love those cartoons. I think we focused on the, and we did go outside the sort of 40s stuff, but we focused on that era because I think it was our very favorite stuff. And we felt like Looney Tunes and the popular consciousness had kind of reduced down into, had been distilled into one particular flavor, and that was sort of the 50s Chuck Jones version of the characters, which is wonderful. You know, there's a reason why that stuff has been so celebrated and why people are so familiar with those versions of the characters. But we sort of felt like, again, Looney Tunes is this hugely varied series of short films. It's, again, over 1,000 films that span, almost 4 decades. And we just wanted to reintroduce everybody to all the great things about it. It felt like we had gotten to a point where if you asked somebody what Looney Tunes were, they would sort of say, oh yeah, duck season, wabbit season, duck season, wabbit season. You know, and you're like, yeah, that's great. But do you know about Great Piggy Bank Robbery? Do you know about, all these, Falling Hair or all these, great things that happened sort of earlier in the series? And I think that stuff was a little less familiar. It was kind of like, realizing that, the general public only knew like one Beatles album, there's like one really famous Beatles album and you're like, yeah, that's a great album, but there's all of these ones too, so we wanted to get in there and celebrate that stuff. But we'd love to do more stuff with the, kind of the more kind of 50s versions of the characters as well.
And I would love to see you guys do eras. So you did the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. So it'd be really cool if Warner Brothers revisits that and you guys get to do like a chunk or a decade here, a decade there of just an homage to these great cartoons. Now, I read the book Chuck-A-Muck not too long ago, a couple years ago, and there was something that I found. I don't know why I never thought about it, but he had like do's and don'ts, like what characters would do, what they would be motivated by, mainly Wile E. Coyote, right?
Yeah.
And, if you would have asked me 15, 20 years ago, I would have been like, Daffy Duck is my favorite Looney Tune of all time. And then it's kind of morphed into like, well, I've got four that I can't, gun to my head, I couldn't pick one. Daffy.
What are the four?
Daffy, Foghorn Leghorn, because fried chicken is my favorite thing in the world. Plus, okay. I love Foghorn Leghorn. I really love Wile E. Coyote. I think he is a phenomenal character. And of course, why am I blanking? Yosemite. I don't know why I blanked on Yosemite Sam. Yosemite Sam, him being a redhead, hothead.
I was going to say, because you look like him?
Yeah. That's 100% of what it is. I'm his bigger brother. But yeah, it was just, he's such a fun character too. It's just, he's always angry. He's always, his temper gets the best of him and then he always ends up losing regardless. But what I loved about reading that book, Chuck-A-Muck, other than it just being very wild, it took me a little bit to like understand Chuck's flow with the book because it was written very weird in a way. It's just like, you have to like get his sense of humor. You have to get what he was thinking. I was trying to put, and it didn't help that I was eating edibles before reading this. That probably didn't help at all. You know what I mean? So there's probably nothing against Chuck's writing. It was all about the edibles I was eating, but that's neither here nor there. But getting to that Wile E. Coyote thing, it was like, this is what he would do. This is what he wouldn't do. This is what he's motivated by. This is what he's not motivated by. Did you guys have anything like that specifically? Were you guys calling on some of those older directors that might have had do's or do nots, or maybe even the studio, Warner Brothers, do's or do nots?
The studio really, I can't tell you the amount of freedom we had on this project. It was really amazing. And it was something, this project felt like something that couldn't have happened 2 years earlier and couldn't have happened 2 years later. It was something that Sam was able to get this project to happen at this time. It wasn't even sold when he was like, we'll make the cartoons and we'll figure out who's going to buy them or where we're going to put them after we make them, and I had come from, I shouldn't be too disparaging by the companies, but I had come from Disney, as I had mentioned, and through no fault of any individuals I was working with, like I said, there is a lot of sort of classic properties we're trying to get off the ground, but there was always either a preciousness or this is hand-wringing about everything, every character, any character you could imagine. There was just a lot of like, can kids relate to this character? Can kids relate to the Cheshire Cat still? Do we need to do something? Do we need to do we need to redress Mr. Toad in a way that's more contemporary so that, kids can get, does anybody really know who the character is more, it doesn't matter who the character was. It was just a lot of having people do tons of work, piles of work, incredibly talented, brilliant industry people, doing mountains of work so that they could kind of, you know, look at it and wring hands and go like, that's cool. Yeah, we'll probably won't do that. But that was cool that we sort of explored that avenue. So after going through a year and a half of that and then going to Warner Brothers and basically just being given, you know, Pete and I being given the keys to the kingdom and kind of just do what you
left
want.
Alone.
It's just like do the characters you want to do as much as you want to and do them the way you want to do them was amazing. Here's the question again. It was about rules. So I think one of the biggest challenges of the project was teaching ourselves the rules. I think we all went in with a tremendous amount of familiarity with the cartoons, but just because you're familiar with something doesn't mean you know how to do it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You can, maybe you've seen the Nutcracker Ballet, you know, 100 times, but that doesn't mean that you can get up on stage and do a plié or I don't know, whatever a ballet dance move is. So we got in there and it was by sort of trying things and them not feeling right and going back and kind of rethinking them that we sort of figured like, well, what is, I mean, it sounds silly and obvious, but what is Daffy Duck's personality? What is funny? What is the thing you want to watch Daffy Duck do? What is the, you know, and how do you orchestrate a situation to allow them to do that? And then you go back and look at the old films again and you realize, you know, these are characters that came out of a process of evolution. You know, none of them came out of the womb fully formed. You can watch, there's like 4 cartoons of kind of Bugs Bunny. It's not really Bugs Bunny, but it's a Bugs-like character. Mm-hmm. And they're doing different things with him and pairing him with different types of characters and putting him in different types of situations. And it's not until Tex Avery does A Wild Hare that it clicks. And it's like, oh, that's what works about that character. And that's the type of situation you put him in. And that's the type of character you put him with that makes him funny. So you have to relearn all that stuff. That you can't put any 2 characters together. You can't put Bugs Bunny and Porky Pig together in the same cartoon and expect that the laughs are going to start coming. It doesn't, those characters don't work together. I mean, I think we knew better than to do that, but so we bent back to, and were just very strategic about, you know, what characters we went with which and what, you know, what, again, it's all about sort of contriving a little, you know, each cartoon's a little gag factory and you have to make sure all the little gears are in place in order for that machine to do its job. And it sometimes takes a little bit. I remember, and you brought up the coyote specifically. I remember it took us a little bit to sort of learn how to write a coyote gag. I think we discovered early, like, you can have a stick of dynamite blow up in that character's face, but that doesn't mean it's funny. And there's a way those jokes unfold where you set up expectations to go a certain way, and then something makes a left turn and happens a different way. And then the dynamite goes off at a point where you didn't expect. You thought it was going to go off, you know, a minute and a half earlier, and then it, you know, or 30 seconds earlier, and then it goes off later. That's what's funny. But it took a little while to sort of figure out how the mechanics of that stuff worked. So I think it was teaching ourselves the rules. That those rules in that book, I haven't read that book in a long time. I remember doing like a book report on it, Chuck-a-Muck, like in middle school, and loving it. Mm-hmm. And that list of rules he gives for the Roadrunner gets a lot of attention. I hear a lot of people bring that up because it feels very true. You know, it's true to the character. You realize the mechanics that were at work in those cartoons. People who have worked on those cartoons have said, yeah, Chuck came up with those rules years after the cartoons were done. It wasn't like those were pinned on the wall and everybody had to. And they break a lot of those rules in the cartoons. But they were useful. And so even on our cartoons, it wasn't like we pinned those up. We break some of those rules sometimes. But we tried to, you know, obey the spirit of it. And there were times when would refer to it. It was just like, the Roadrunner's kind of doing something there. You know, the Roadrunner can't do anything. You know, Wily has to defeat himself. The Roadrunner can't defeat Wily. And there was another, we wrote a whole cartoon. Kenny Pittenger cartoon. There's a cartoon we wrote around the idea that the Roadrunner can't leave the road, which was one of his rules, which is a rule that we broke in other cartoons. But in this particular cartoon, we're like, okay, what if it's true that the Roadrunner can never leave the road? Then what if the coyote built a, you know, street paving machine and was making roads for the Roadrunner to run on, you know, and trying to like trap and isolate him? What could you do with that? And so then, you know, fun ideas could come out of that. Sorry, that was a really long-winded answer.
Oh, no, I like long-winded answers because it opens up other avenues. It opens up another road for us to travel down, like the Roadrunner. with that being said, you know, you said there was 1,000 of these cartoons already, and then you guys go and do 1,000 minutes is what the studio was wanting.
Yeah.
How fucking hard is that? Because there's so much Looney Tunes stuff out there already, and then you guys are having to take these characters. And you're in this era, so, you know, they're obviously going to follow those norms, whether it was, you know, the view of the character or what they would do or how they would sound like they would in the 40s. How hard is it to come up with something new with these characters? Because I feel like everything was probably already said. I got to imagine this was pretty difficult to do.
Yeah, it is hard. I mean, you wonder. I don't know why I'm talking about other. I always think about The Simpsons. Like, what do they talk about in that Simpsons writer's room? Like, 35 years of that show. How do you come up with a story? I watched the new ones. There's some great ones still coming out of that show, but I don't know how you start that conversation when there's so much history. It was very intimidating initially. I don't have a pat answer for that. I think we were careful not to use modern. I think we used modern ideas when it was a good idea. Like if there was a, you know, there's a, we did an episode of Bugs in a Self-Driving Car, and we did an episode with Porky Pig using sort of an Alexa like voice recognizing, you know, because the writers came up with a funny idea about what you could do with that character in that situation. And we were sort of like, well, if those things had existed when the original cartoon makers were around, yes, they would have used them for gags like that. You know, we have a drone in one of the coyote shorts, but we also didn't want to use that as a formula. We didn't want every cartoon to be launching off from a modern situation and just transplanting the characters into that. That was sort of a formula we didn't want to avoid. When they had the first press art for the show, you know, Max was very hot to have us have an image of Bugs holding a cell phone because they really wanted that to come off as sort of the angle of the show, but it really wasn't. And we did stuff. We knew the classic cartoons pretty well, but even still, we kind of stumbled into some premises that were similar to things they had done. And there had been so much stuff done in the modern era that I was not familiar with at all. And initially, we asked for a list of premises that had been done on either Wabbit or the new Looney Tunes show or whatever, so we could make sure we didn't do something that they had done. But it sort of became exhausting every time we did a cartoon to look through, you know, it's like, oh, did they do Yosemite Sam as a conquistador? I don't, you know, and then we just did it. And we were like, I think our justification, if there was a justification, is in the classic era, those guys would return to similar premises over and over again. But it was usually if they thought they could get sort of new material out of it, new gags or whatever. So we were like, you can't avoid, you know, it's like, yes, we can do Sylvester and Tweety in a zoo. And yes, that's been done before. But if we can come up with a new situation in that zoo that hasn't been done or new gags that haven't been done, then it's worth doing it. Because all you're trying to do is make your audience laugh. And if you can make them laugh and, you know, hopefully using original gags that haven't, you know, that weren't in another cartoon, then you're succeeding in your goal. You can never be, you know, 100% original when making, you know, hundreds of cartoons with these characters.
Yeah.
You just try to be as inventive as you can while still being true to the spirit of what it originally was.
Beautifully put. I got a couple more questions here before we start winding down, but sure. Any of the newer episodes that you guys worked on that you wanted to pay homage to something that you grew up with, whether it was a scene, whether it was a gag, whether it was a character, is there anything that stick out? You said, I would love to pay tribute to X, Y, and Z for this.
Yeah, there was tons. I'm hard pressed to think of an example off the top of my head.
You want to come back to that question? Let you think
about
it.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think I brought up some of the characters that I was very excited to use because they had meant something. I mean, that's the thing with a body of work as big as the classic Looney Tunes are. It's sort of, and that was what was fun about working with our whole crew. I mean, I know I'm talking so much about me, but it was a huge crew that made these cartoons. We got a huge boarding crew. I think it was, let's say, like 10 board artists, and it was really fascinating to learn that for each person something different was iconic. You know, there was a Looney Tune that was iconic to this person, even though I don't really remember that one. And we kept finding that over and over again and allowing everybody to just like, okay, these characters mean something to you, or this genre this type of cartoon means something to you, then pursue it because you're going to bring something to it because of your love. I think the one that I feel very attached to is a cartoon called Hex Appeal, which is a Witch Hazel cartoon that was in our Halloween episode. Initially, at the start of the project, there was a lot of discussion. Warner Brothers not only wanted us to do 1,000 minutes of Looney Tunes, but they floated the idea of like maybe every Looney Tune is in a different style. And Pete and I knew how impossible that would be to do. You know, again, like you're saying, like learning the rules, like just learning the basic rules is hard enough without having to reinvent the rules in every single cartoon. So we kind of knew we weren't going to do every cartoon in a different style. But we did start coming up with some ideas of things that would be kind of outliers. Like this will be kind of a different kind of short than the other ones. And we had some ideas for that very early on. And very early on, I had an idea to do a solo cartoon with Witch Hazel, who had kind of only ever been used as an antagonist character, mostly in Bugs Bunny shorts. I was like, I think that's a great character. I think she can support a cartoon on her own. And I think we can come up with a kind of cool, different visual style for this cartoon. And what I wanted to do is to look at some of the influences that Chuck Jones was influenced by when he made his cartoons, rather than sort of arbitrarily coming up with a new style. And I knew he was very inspired by this British cartoonist, Ronald Searle. So I sort of used that as a jumping off point to come up with this style, and then use some other sort of techniques like color blocking and things like that to come up with a different kind of look for this cartoon, but that still felt true to the original cartoons with this character and to the spirit of that cartoon. And I had a great team. The overseas studio, Yauza, did an amazing job executing that cartoon. Mike Rocco boarded that cartoon. He got exactly what it was that I wanted to do with it. Dave Gemmel did an amazing job directing it. So, I mean, there was a whole bunch of people who executed it, but it was an idea that I had early on that I really wanted to try, and we did it, and it turned out great. It's something I'm very, very proud of.
Right on, man. And as you should be, man, a lot of these shorts, I want to go back and rewatch these, especially now that the kids are getting a little bit older. So he's able to like latch onto a character. Like he's at that stage where the last few months have been nothing but Sesame Street, which I absolutely love.
Yeah.
And then Mickey Mouse Clubhouse.
Yeah.
And it's cool because I noticed really early, because I missed the first 4 years of my oldest son's life because of deployments. So I didn't hit that developmental stage where it's like they'll pick up on stuff, but it's like there's certain things you don't want them to pick up on. So I've got Ninja Turtles all the way up and down my arm. There's nothing but Ninja Turtles in front of me. So Ninja Turtles has just been so present in my life for the longest time that I forget. They have the tendency to be a little bit violent. And like I said, kids are sponges and they pick up doing, right? So we're sitting here watching Ninja Turtles. And, you know, he picks up, I don't know what he picked up, but he ended up using it as a staff. And he goes over there and cracks my oldest with it. And I'm like, oh, shit, I don't know. I don't think we should be watching Ninja Turtles right now. Maybe like pump the brakes for a little bit, right? So,
and Looney Tunes are like that. I mean, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, no, you're perfectly fine. So we pumped the brakes on the Looney Tunes too, because we were watching some shit. I'm like, oh, man, I don't want to get him on this just yet. But he's at that stage where we'll watch a lot of the original Wile E. Coyotes and Roadrunners and things like that, where it's not so crazy where they're picking up stuff and smashing each other with. It's a little bit more dropping anvils and things like that. But
it's a little more abstract. And the Looney Tunes are kind of interesting that way, because I remember that too, being very excited to introduce my kids to Looney Tunes, but realizing they weren't going to appreciate it until they were older. And there's a reason why Disney is Disney and it's as successful as it is. There's the bulk of their content, both then and now. I mean, maybe not entirely now, but you know, the classic stuff, you can put it on for your kids and feel relatively safe. There might be some racial things or whatever that don't date so well, but outside of that, like it's gentle in a way that is very appealing to young kids. Mm-hmm. Looney Tunes are not gentle. They're extremely antagonistic. They're about characters in conflict, fighting with each other, and it is about exaggerated violence. And yes, they were made for adult audiences, mm-hmm. and kids enjoyed them as well. But there's a lot of flavors in there, you know, irony and things like that, that don't, and a lot of pop culture references and things that don't play great with, a three-year-old necessarily. Yeah. But you get there, and it's great to see, you know, it was very exciting. I'm trying to think of what age my kids kind of locked into Looney Tunes. And again, my youngest is 12 and he still loves them. But ours are very violent. And I don't recommend putting them on for very young kids. Again, they just won't appreciate them. You know, I think your kids get a little older and they're going to get really into them, but don't have to rush it. Don't have to rush it.
No, I've been very hesitant in showing, even with my oldest, like things that I grew up and loved. Like I was very, like he's into karate now. He's one stripe away from his black belt. And even got into karate, I was very hesitant in showing him any. Jackie Chan is like my hero. Like when it comes to action movies, he is my hero. Yeah. Same thing with Bruce. I love Bruce Lee movies. But I was very hesitant in showing him those, because I really feel like you only get one chance to show him something special like that. And the last thing you want him to do is be like, meh. And then you're like, I don't think you're my kid anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, I've had that same thought with so many things, but Jackie Chan specifically, like I love those, the 80s and 90s Jackie Chan movies. And I remember, you know, just really agonizing over what was the right age to kind of show them. And I kind of never did. I remember showing some isolated scenes, but it was, you know, it was like, how do I sort of frame all this violence? But it is kind of like Looney Tunes. A lot of it is comedic violence. That's part of what I love about it is so much of the good stuff there's almost a comedic premise behind what he's doing. And yes, he's punching, you know, 20 guys in the face, but it's really funny, but
it's so cool.
it's hard to know when to trot out that stuff, you know.
Oh, absolutely.
And there's always that's the thing is I realize there's always time. There's a, you know, now I'm sort of like you know, it's like Hitchcock and sort of gateway horror stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, when do I start showing, and they don't really have any interest in any of that stuff. It's stuff that's important to me. And I'm like, is it important that and when I say gateway horror, I mean, you know, Jaws or, you know, Alien or things like that, you know, well, that's not even gateway. That's full on horror, but,
shit.
I'm not going to show my kids Texas Chainsaw Massacre, but you know, there's some creature features and things that I love, you know, that I, it would be great to show them, but I don't know. It's hard to know when's the right time. Cause you're right. If you bring it out too early and it traumatizes them, then you're going to have to wait, you know, another 5 years, you know, before you get another shot at it. So I feel your pain 100%.
We did Jaws with my oldest when he was probably six, and you know he is. We live in Florida, so he's been fascinated with sharks. Like, you know, when your kids go to school, like kindergarten, pre-K, whatever it is, and they fill out that little thing of like, what do you want to be when you grow up? I think he was kindergarten, first grade, something around there. And they go, what do you want to be when you grow up? And he said, I want to be a ninja that scuba dives and looks for sharks, right?
So perfect sense. Yes.
Absolutely, right? He's got the full gamut of occupation, but
not a huge field. It's very specific, but you know.
It's a very niche market, you know. I mean? Yeah. He'll find his community for sure. It's a callback, ladies and gentlemen. But he was just balls deep into sharks, anything with sharks, posters, books, just loved it. And I was like, man, I think it's time for Jaws. And my wife looks at me, she's like, are you sure he's ready? And I was like, well, hell, man, I watched this when I was his age. And she was like, yeah, and your brother watched it a year and a half, 2 years younger than you. And he would not sit on the toilet by himself because he was convinced Jaws was going to come up. He wouldn't sit in the bathtub because
that happened to my
Jaws
wife.
Come up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So I was like, I think he'll be ready. And like he, just like I was with Cartoon Network when Cartoon Network first came on, he was sitting there like he didn't understand like what was going on. He just saw this. He saw Bruce coming from the water with his mouth open. He's like, oh, my God, this is so cool. You know, so every Saturday night we do movie night. So we pick something new. Sometimes we'll pick just a movie that we loved growing up as kids that we know is just not that good. And sometimes we'll show them some really, really good stuff. So that kid's got like I've got nothing but what's the word I'm looking for? He's going to be just fine when it comes to film, when it comes to movies, when it comes to cartoons, because he's seen everything, anything from Goonies to Back to the Future to anything in between. Right. So he's good and set up. The Jackie Chan stuff stuck with him when he was about 10, and then he got into karate and now he's all about it. He loves anime. I'm still kind of hesitant in showing him anything Miyazaki because he loves the current anime and stuff. And it's not that I'm calling him dumb, but I just don't think he's emotionally aware enough to know what's going on in the scene. I just don't like what you're saying. Appreciate wise. I don't think he'll appreciate it the way that I appreciate it because of the mastery that's on the screen. Yeah. If you know what I mean.
It's complex stuff and you have you have to be sort of ready for it on some level. And it's paced very differently. If you're used to watching anime, that's all, a lot of action and fighting. And there is action in Miyazaki, but it's
a slow build.
It's a slow build and the context is always very different. And there's always a very, the conflict behind it is much more complex. Like who are the good guys? Who are the bad guys? And, you know, so yeah, but again, you'll get there.
Oh yeah. Oh, yeah, 100%. So as we start to wind down, there's these questions I like to ask, especially when it comes to something that is, Looney Tunes are the zeitgeist, right? I mean, everybody knows who Bugs, you can go anywhere in this world, you know Bugs, you know Daffy, you know all of these characters, man. But let's, in a hypothetical world, let's say you meet somebody that doesn't know the Looney Tunes, and you've got one shot, one episode, one short to say, hey, I know you're going to get hooked on this. What one short, what one shot, what one character are you gonna tell them to go with?
Dear Lord.
Heavy hitting questions, Alex. Welcome to the show.
Yeah. I don't know. Because you get into this, like, is it showing what I love about it, or is it showing, you know, is it a showcase for, you know, I think those the Jones Rabbit what is it? What do they call it? Basically the Daffy, Bugs, Elmer trilogy, you know, Rabbit, mm-hmm. Fire, and, you know, the Duck season, Rabbit season, whatever. I guess if you're introducing a caveman who's never seen Looney Tunes before, that's not a bad place to start. Yeah. But if I'm showing what I love about Looney Tunes, it probably is more, you know, Kitty Cornered or A Great Piggy Bank Robbery or something like that. That's much more specific and weird and unhinged, you know.
Right on, man. If you could go back in time and watch one of these shorts that you love so much for the first time all over again, which one would you pick?
Oh my gosh. I think it would probably be like what I maybe Piggy Bank Robbery, which I know is one that you bring up a lot, but it is sort of, it's just one of those cartoons where you feel like your brain melted the first mm-hmm. time you watched it. And so I can't think of a better example. You know, I don't remember the first time I watched that cartoon. I wish I did. I'm trying to think of one where maybe my brain melted the first time I saw it. I can specifically remember. I can't. I wish I could. But again, it would probably be like a Clampett cartoon from that era, like Piggy Bank Robbery.
Good choices. So if you could take one of these Looney Tunes shorts that you guys got to work on, one of the new ones, and you could go up to Bob, say Bob was here right now, and you could say, look at my boards, look at the story, look at this. What's one question about a storyboard, about writing, about a character that you would love to ask Bob?
Gosh, that's a really good question. I think I would ask him, well, okay. What I wanted to say is a question that I know writers hate, which is the question, where do your ideas come from? Because obviously there's not a set place where the ideas can be anywhere and are everywhere. And it's almost sort of arbitrary what you kind of glom onto. It's not like there's a secret fountain of ideas, but I guess it's more, where do you start when you know you're going to do a Bugs short? You know, where do you start when trying to decide what it is you're going to do this time around? One of the things I really enjoy about Bob Clampett cartoons is there's not a lot of formula there. You know, compared to some of the other directors who were, you know, Chuck Jones, you know, I don't want to be dismissive of the formula. I think Chuck Jones built a Bugs Bunny formula that is like a Swiss watch. The parts are so beautiful and strategic and work so incredibly well. But that just wasn't how Bob Clampett thought. He wasn't like, oh, you need to start with Bugs Bunny minding his own business, and then a bully is going to come in and disturb what he's doing, and then Bugs is going to decide to retaliate. He starts in a totally different place in every cartoon, and you know, just to take Bugs Bunny, is Bugs Bunny's personality is almost different in every single cartoon. He has sort of a different defining trait where either he's a victim or Bugs is the bully this time around, or he has some different extreme emotion. This one, Bugs really wants the Oscar, so he's very sort of selfish and sort of, you know, self-aggrandizing. Just kind of where do you start, and then how do you pack so many, how do you build a structure that can hold so many ideas? If you're not using the same structure every time, how do you make sure you can get so many ideas into one short?
Gotcha. If you could own one piece of, whether it was a cell, a storyboard, a script, a model sheet, an original, essentially, of whichever one you'd pick from any of these shorts, cartoons, what would it be?
And I mean, if we're totally blue skying, we could own anything. Maybe I'm getting too outside the box, but there's... here in LA, we have the Motion Picture Academy Museum, and they have this beautiful hand-sculpted Bugs Bunny maquette from the 1940s that's from the Clampett unit that I think the Smithsonian restored. Ruth was telling us about that. It's beautiful. I'd love to have that little Bugs Bunny statue on my shelf. So I don't know if that's a cheater answer, but...
No, I like it.
From a particular short. There's actually, because I'm thinking of sculpture, because I love toys and things, obviously. There's a 30s black and white Porky Pig cartoon called Porky's Hero Agency that has a beautiful, the title card is a photograph of a Porky Pig statue that's just beautiful. And I would love to own that as well.
That'd be really cool to see. And last question here. If you could summarize your time on Looney Tunes in one word, one phrase, one sentence, one paragraph, what would it sound like?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. I want to say dream come true. I mean, it was something I never thought would happen to me. And then once I got the job, I didn't know if we could pull it off. I didn't know, you know, again, not to be about anyone else. I didn't know that, you know, I could pull off something that, you know, I could be proud of. And the project was so much fun, and working with those characters was, yeah, an absolute dream come true. And getting to work with the team I did was a dream come true as well.
Oh, that's really cool to hear. And I hope that the people that got to work with you, I hope they get to see this and hope they get to see those words, because it'll mean a lot for folks. There's something that goes without saying. It's like the experiences are the experiences. The job is the job, but the people make everything worthwhile. And you've got a great team, no matter what, you could have the shittiest job in the world, but the people make you come back each time. And it sounds like you had such a great time because the people, you guys were all collectively trying to do the same thing. You took these characters that we all grew up on, that we all love, that we all have this reverence for. And then you guys wanted to pay respect. You wanted to punch up. You wanted to do whatever it is you could to leave your stamp, your mark on these characters that are just so iconic. And from me to you, man, you guys absolutely crushed it. Like I said, I love these shorts. I want to go back and watch the entire series again that you guys did, because they're beautifully done. Oh, thank you, man. It's like you look at this and it's like every one of these shorts feels like it's big budget. It looks like you guys had piles of money to just go throw more into it, throw more paint, throw more sketches, throw more characters.
I tell you, designs. We did not. but thank you, man. We worked. I mean, we worked really hard to polish those things to try to live up to the legacy as best as we could. So we tried really, really hard. And, you know, our team, our incredible board team, and our art team, you know, our art director Aaron Spurgeon and Keiko Yamaguchi, they just worked miracle after miracle. You look at these backgrounds and be like, we did an interview with, I think it was like New York Times at the very beginning, and they asked us if we had used backgrounds from vintage cartoons. Mm-hmm. They were like, okay, you're doing these with old backgrounds, right? And I'm like, no, we're creating all of these from scratch, you know, digitally. And there was another story too. Warner Brothers sent these shorts to, it was HBO Max at the time, you know, because they were going to air them. And HBO Max came back to Warner Brothers and said, oh no, you sent us the wrong cartoons. You sent us the classic shorts. We were looking really for cool. The new, you know, the new Looney Tunes cartoon series. And they were like, those are the new Looney Tunes cartoon series. Those are not classic shorts. So we felt really good at ourselves when we heard that story.
That's so cool.
We got them.
We crushed it.
Yeah.
Well, man, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for spending some time with me. Where can folks go and find you if they say, hey, I really love what you did on the Looney Tunes? Where are you at on social media?
Oh, I'm on Instagram. You can go to Alex Kirtoon. That's KIRTOON on Instagram. And I post some Looney Tunes stuff and stuff from everything else I've worked on there as well. And I will be posting from, you were asking if there's something to plug. We made a movie. They haven't announced where and when that movie is coming out, but it is coming out. And so I say stay tuned, you know, to find out where that's going to manifest. I know I'll be writing about it on social media, and it should be very, very cool.
Yeah, I can't wait. I'm really hoping it's soon, because like I said, if we need anything right now, we need more Looney Tunes. We need more laughs. Well, he's been Alex. I've been Julian. It's been a What's My Head podcast, and it's been another piece of your childhood. Good night.
Hey guys, it's your resident cartoon junkie Brandon Jones here, asking you to have a listen to my Animation Destination podcast. It's an animation celebration podcast, and it's full of all sorts of stuff about anime and cartoons and voice acting and all that sort of thing, and just a really all-around celebration of anything animated. So come on by and check it out. We've got fan episodes of your favorite animes to your most obscure cartoons on Netflix that no one's ever heard of, and just really love talking about it. You can subscribe to us on Spotify and iTunes and anywhere else you can get your podcasts from. So stop on by, subscribe, and stay tuned for the Animation Destination Podcast.
Hey guys, thanks for listening. Before we go, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with the podcast today. I truly appreciate every download and listen we get. If you're liking what we're doing, drop us a 5-star rating, drop us a review, tell a friend, and I'll see you next week.